This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque. If you're one of the 2% of Americans driving an electric car, you might be excused for not knowing. Gas prices are up, way up. For the rest of you, you already know. How much are they up and why? Let's talk to Patrick Dehanis with GasBuddy.com to get some insight on that. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us on the West Texas Dispatch this morning.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start off with where we are today with gas prices in Texas. How do they look?
Well, they don't look real good. That's been a kind of a consistent refrain across the country. The average in Texas now, $3.61 a gallon. That is up a dollar from where we were just a month ago.
Diesel, even worse, right?
Yeah, diesel even worse, getting very close to that $5 a gallon mark, something that we've already seen nationally. Diesel is up even more dramatically than that of gasoline. Prior to the U.S. attacks on Iran, average diesel was at $3.64. This morning, $5.35 for a national average of diesel. Texas a little bit lower, just under the $5 mark at $4.98.
Why does it matter so much that diesel prices are so high, Patrick?
Well, you know, you and I might be filling up with gasoline, but diesel is the fuel that powers the engines that make up the U.S. economy, from trains to truckers to tractors out in the field. I mean, this is really the fuel of the U.S. economy. And the fact that diesel now is at its highest since 2022 at $5.35 a gallon, you know, that's going to impact you the next time you try to book a trip overseas and get on a plane. And the next time you go to the grocery store, all of those goods, whether it be produce, meats, everything gets to the grocery store with a semi truck. And so you're likely to feel the impacts. And in fact, it's so significant that inflation is likely to start swinging back to the upside, primarily because the price of diesel fuel is so high.
Well, we know the threats at the Strait of Hormuz have helped create this dramatic inflation that we've seen. You just mentioned basically a dollar in 1 month. News of a possible deal that saw the barrel go down $10 just a couple of days ago. Have you ever seen this kind of a big roller coaster with prices going up and down this fast, Patrick?
Yeah, not really. You know, this is, even 2022, I mean, it was a pretty tumultuous time then because not only was supply impacted like it is now, but demand was impacted back in 2022 because of the U.S. economy reopening and really the global economy reopening. But back then, the supply part of the equation was smaller. Russia's impact on the global market is smaller than the Strait of Hormuz, which, by the way, carries about 20% of the world's daily crude oil supply to the market from Middle Eastern oil producers through the Persian Gulf, through the Strait of Hormuz, out to the global market. And this is arguably a much bigger impact to supply than we've ever seen.
Patrick, let's talk about that. The Strait of Hormuz is literally on the other side of the world. Couldn't be any further from us. Here at home in West Texas, we have the Permian Basin, which much of America's oil is literally in our backyards. I think people get confused on why our gas prices are going up if the oil is in our backyard.
Well, first and foremost, only because exports were legalized in 2015, did the U.S. oil production numbers start to skyrocket because oil producers said, hey, we can sell it in the U.S. and abroad. Let's increase production. So, you know, if we were to magically fence ourselves off, keep in mind that we wouldn't have the amount of oil that we did back then today because exports were legal. Now, the other part of the equation here, as you mentioned, we are susceptible because of the very global economy that defines, you know, the success of U.S. oil companies. We can't fence ourselves off. We can't insulate ourselves. It's a global economy. It's very connected. And when buyers in China can no longer buy Middle Eastern crude oil, guess who they're going to knock on the door of? Oh, hello, U.S. oil producers. And suddenly it's Chinese consumption and consumers bidding up the same product that you and I are relying on. And that global economy means the price is basically globally determined by a balance of supply and demand. It's not just, you know, an arbitrary number in the United States if you pay this. Other countries can very much bid up and buy U.S. oil at the market price, which is going up, and oil companies will sell not to the lowest bidder, but to the highest bidder. Just like if your house is on the market, you're not going to sell to the lowest bidder, you sell to the highest bidder.
Patrick, the million-dollar question, actually, I guess more like a trillion-dollar question, where do oil prices go from here? What is your sense? Do you have any sense of where they go?
I mean, you know, some sense based on the headlines. And right now we're seeing some potential that there's going to be talks between the U.S. and Iran, at least dialogue. And Iran is denying it. But even then, you know, over the last couple of days, we've seen a tremendous shift in the U.S. in terms of the Trump administration, who had doubled down on not negotiating last week with Iran and had doubled down on potentially attacking Iran's nuclear facilities and their power plants. And so the Trump administration has softened that tone now drastically, and oil prices plummeting on the possibility that there could be a peace deal. Now, Iran has denied it. There's other countries that are getting involved. So, you know, we're not exactly sure what's happening. But even just looking at the Trump administration, a drastic shift in what's being said. And oil markets are responding to that as an improvement. And that's why oil prices have declined. But there's still a lot to be learned on whether or not there will be any fruitful, you know, discussions and any improvement in the outlook here. So oil prices could still swing all over the map, depending on exactly, you know, what happens over the next week or two.
Patrick, some fabulous insights. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Appreciate you having me.
Patrick DeHaan is with GasBuddy.com, talking about some rising gas prices in West Texas and around the world. As the Trump administration's plans for border walls in the rugged Big Bend country of West Texas advance, landowners in the path are struggling to understand how the plan could impact their homes and their livelihoods. Amid a lack of details from U.S. Customs and Border Protection, advocates are rushing to help landowners with legal aid in sparsely populated rural areas along the Rio Grande. That's where local residents have started receiving government letters threatening the seizure of their land for the project. Marfa Public Radio's Mary Cantrell has this story.
Let's make sure if you haven't signed up with this, please give us your information before you go.
David Keller from the newly formed group No Big Bend Border Wall speaks at a landowner meeting in Redford, a small community outside of Presidio on the Texas-Mexico border. Border wall plans have never progressed this far here before. In recent weeks, locals opposing the wall have rushed to form a landowner coalition, coordinate legal access, and educate landowners on their rights. Keller, who lives in Redford, says letters seeking landowner authorization for border wall construction are stoking fear and anger.
Most of them don't have attorneys on file. Most of them don't. English is not their first language, and this is written in coercive language.
He's been urging his neighbors not to sign anything and to lawyer up.
We're all in this fight together, and we got to have each other's backs, man. And if you know people that you feel are going to sign, you know, talk to them. Try to get them not to.
Local farmer Esteban Mesa opens a gate on his property in Redford, which backs up to the Rio Grande. Mesa and other farmers here pump water directly from the river to their fields. He says a border wall would cut off access to his pump, making it impossible to irrigate.
I know that they're not going to, with the way this valley is, they're not going to be putting a gate at her property owner's property.
Mesa lives on a farm that has been in his wife's family for 150 years. He gets emotional talking about the dedication it takes to run these family farms despite mounting challenges of drought, climate change, and now the border wall.
And the majority of the true family farms and ranches, people have to work off-site to make a living because it's just so very, very difficult. But it's in the blood. It's like you just can't walk away from it. I mean, it's a legacy, you know, passed on.
Redford was once a thriving community, with a schoolhouse and an acequia or irrigation ditch that brought river water to farms. But the school has long closed and the acequia now runs dry. The families that still remain, despite the odds, have been there for generations. Mesa quickly detours from our conversation to point out his neighbor, Armando Carrasco, as he drives by.
There goes Mr. Carrasco.
Carrasco is from one of the oldest families in Redford and lives across from a church where Mass is still held once a month. He says he's concerned about how the wall would impact flooding and the town's levee.
We have several arroyos between here and Presidio. And so how are they going to build a wall through those arroyos?
Carrasco discusses life on the borderlands, recalling how workers from Palomas, the town on the other side of the river, used to come over more frequently. His cattle are hungry for their morning hay.
You know, we don't understand the cartels, how they work, but...
While CBP has already awarded more than $3 billion in contracts for wall construction in the area, its urgent pursuit of the project has led to botched communication with local landowners. Esteban Mesa says he hasn't received a single letter from CBP.
Right now, my frustration is I want to be able to have a voice.
Other landowners have received letters from CBP asking them to authorize border wall construction on property they don't even own. Cynthia Ramirez is Presidio County's chief property appraiser. She says the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is relying on the appraisal district's maps, which lack a certain level of detail, to locate landowners. Generational land along the river is complex, she says. Surveys are lacking, and the land has been subdivided. Ramirez says she's seen cases of CBP sending letters out to every property owner within a section of land, 640 acres, regardless of if they are near the border or not.
Because if there's multiple owners in a section, they're overlapping on top of each other, the parcels. So they're not going to be able to pinpoint exactly where Jane's property is because she doesn't have a survey.
The federal government is spending $17.6 million per mile for the wall plans in a poor region struggling to afford basic infrastructure like ambulances and running water. Many, including five local sheriffs, say the wall simply isn't needed. Back in Redford, Carrasco sits underneath a metal pavilion surrounded by farm tools and machinery. He says if the wall isn't needed, why limit local farmers' movements on their own land?
Why go through that expense? Why change the way things are always being here? We're free.
CBP has said border wall construction would start towards the end of the year. It's unclear when the government might start condemning land for the project. The agency is currently taking public comments on the plan until April 6th. I'm Mary Cantrell in Marfa.
Yesterday was National Ag Day, which celebrates the individuals who feed, clothe, and fuel America. It comes at a time with rising fuel costs that we just talked about and other inflationary pressures that add to a risk of hunger. That's true in all communities, but it can be especially acute in rural areas where we also find farmers who are dealing with challenges. The Emergency Food Assistance Program aims to help U.S. farm-grown food get to families, which also creates a system that supports farmers and agricultural producers. How much of this is helping and what could be done? Libby Stevens, Executive Director of the West Texas Food Bank in Midland, is on the line to talk to us about it. Welcome, Libby. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me today. I'm always happy to talk about TFAP, our Emergency Food Assistance Program, plus our growers, and also what it does and how it supports and affects rural communities.
Well, you've been in your role since 2012, so you've been there a while. Can you give us some perspective on hunger, especially in rural areas of West Texas?
We serve 19 counties, which is about 34,000 square miles of West Texas, so it's about the same size as the state of Maine, to kind of give you an idea of what that looks like. And we're kind of an unusual food bank because we really do have all three problems that have to do with hunger. So if you think about urban and Midland, Odessa, we have urban hunger. You think about rural, you know, you start going down toward the Big Bend and the Trans-Pecos, that is definitely rural country down there. And then we also deal with the border. We have all three issues, which makes us have to be very creative and innovative about how we reach our neighbors in need. One thing that's also interesting about Midland, Odessa is we don't grow anything. Like, we grow oil and mesquite bushes, but we don't grow a lot of food out here. So the Emergency Food Assistance Program is something that is vital for us to be able to meet the needs of our neighbors in hunger. So TFAP is also an economic stimulator to our growers and producers, especially if there's something, you know, like a two-headed carrot or it's the wrong color of bell pepper and they can't sell it at the store, then what really happens is that goes into the TFAP program, which gives the ability for us to go ahead and give great, nutritious, healthy food to our neighbors in need, especially in rural communities where those kinds of commodities just aren't available.
Can you tell us a little bit about how the Emergency Food Assistance Program actually works?
Absolutely. So inside the Farm Bill, which hasn't been done in a while, there is a line item in there that is for TFAP, the Emergency Food Assistance Program, and that's called entitlement money. And what happens is that based upon a formula that's kind of complicated from USDA, it actually determines how much money or dollars you get to spend in the TFAP catalog with USDA. So all the different kind of commodities get listed in basically like a shopping list. And based on your poverty rate, your census, all those different kinds of things that go into the formula, is then you get to go shop with those dollars onto a list. Also, what can happen is that you can get what they call bonus buys. And what this is that when, you know, for instance, under Trump 1.0, I always say we had trade mitigation, you know, products going on where China didn't want our lentils or our pork or cherries or all kinds of different items. And they will use extra money to buy those commodities, what they call bonus buys, which definitely help our agriculture partners who may be struggling because they may have produced too much. Somebody may not be exporting our goods. So those are different ways that the TFAP program actually helps truly support our agriculture partners. What's really important to realize is that this food that we get at the food bank level is really great, amazing, healthy food. And with that, we're really able to reach those in need, especially when you think of places like, you know, Sanderson, Texas, that doesn't have a grocery store.
Wow.
And their closest grocery store is actually, you know, 80 miles away. It's 160 miles, you know, round trip for our LOLs, as I like to call them, our little old ladies, to drive and to go to a grocery store. They just have like a Stripes, which is a 7-Eleven, and it closes around 7 or 8 o'clock at night. So for us to be able to show up, do a rural distribution there, you know, come into that community and provide healthy food for our seniors is really, really important. And we definitely couldn't do that without TFAP.
You really have a unique situation in far out West Texas, don't you?
We like to think we're unique and different in a fun way.
Very good. We really want to thank you for joining the West Texas Dispatch and sharing your perspective with us today.
Absolutely. And one of the best things that we can say to do is we urge people to support a new farm bill, urge people to help support TFAP, the Emergency Food Assistance Program, for Congress to fund that, appropriations to fund it. If there's extra money, which, you know, I am a beggar by trade, I'll say put it in TFAP for the next farm bill.
All right. Libby Stevens is the executive director of the West Texas Food Bank in Midland, Texas. In December, Texas Tech University faculty received a memorandum from the new system chancellor. It outlined the review process for the Board of Regents for course content discussing race, gender, and sexuality. And now, halfway through the spring semester, Texas Tech professors say they've started to hear back about what they're allowed to include in their lessons. KTTZ's Michelle Wada reports the months of uncertainty have left some students feeling unsupported and the policy impacting them even outside the classroom.
Texas Tech University has often held itself to a high standard when it comes to cultivating a community of students from all walks of life under the motto of, "From here, it's possible." Under new system leadership, many students have reported disruptions and class cancellations that are impacting their education. Brandon Creighton took over as the university system's newest chancellor in November. On December 1st, Creighton released a memorandum which outlined a course review system under the Board of Regents. All classes that discussed race, gender, and sexuality were to be placed under review and have their content changed in preparation for the spring semester. Ainsley Schwintz has lived in Lubbock her whole life. Her decision to attend Texas Tech was born out of her love for the local community and the fact that the university was a public research institution. Schwintz was an active member of the Texas Tech drumline for her first 2 years of school. After catching COVID during her sophomore year and developing disabilities, Schwintz had to transfer to online courses to continue her education. Over winter break, Schwintz received an email from Texas Tech University notifying her that her ethnic minority psychology class had been canceled. Schwintz is a senior interdisciplinary studies major with a concentration in psychology. The email provided no information over why this course had been canceled and gave students a list of other extracurriculars they could sign up for before the spring semester. Schwintz stated that if she hadn't been at her computer, she may not have been able to find another class that was strictly online, which would have pushed back her May graduation.
Like I knew that there were people with diverse opinions, but there was always a dedication to science. These things exist. These are sociological constructs, and pretending like they don't exist is anti-science.
In the course review outline Creighton provided in his memorandum, it was stated that if material was required for a professional licensure or needed for clinical care, the course would be left alone. Schwintz originally wanted to stay and pursue graduate school at Texas Tech, but now intends on moving out of Texas altogether to continue her education. She worries how a degree from Texas Tech will impact admission decisions.
I'm going to be a clinical psychologist someday. I want to help people in the most effective, empirically supported ways. And by taking away classes like ethnic minority psychology, administrators are telling me two things. One, my education doesn't matter to them. And two, they don't care about the students who may find solace in community and spaces dedicated to studies in race, gender, and sexuality.
Classes are not the only thing being disrupted on campus. Samuel Alicio is a sophomore studying marketing and management at the Rawls College of Business. Alicio is notable for his involvement in the Student Government Association, as well as being the director of operations for the on-campus radio station KTXT. At the beginning of the semester, Alicio was told to encourage students to stay away from talking about any form of political rhetoric on the radio. Alicio has not been directly affected by course cancellations, but has seen the effects of cutting DEI programs on campus. Texas Tech DEI programs were effectively shut down in the fall of 2023 in order to comply with Senate Bill 17.
When coming to Tech, I liked that it was a Hispanic-serving institution. I had a full ride to Alabama, and I didn't want to go there because my roots are Venezuelan. I grew up in the United States, but I enjoy the Hispanic culture. And seeing that it was a Hispanic-serving institution did impact my decision a little bit.
Alicio stated that if he had known how his student organizations, classes, and friends would be affected, he would not have considered attending the university.
And it's embarrassing, and I know in the world of academia from what I've heard, but it's like professors are kind of like, they don't want to come here. It's like new professors or professors that could be good, they don't want to come here because they don't want to have to send in their classes to be reviewed. It's like, just let them teach.
On February 26th, members of the Student Government Association passed a resolution that outlines revisions to Crane's memorandum, urging the university to ease restrictions on classes and course overview. Dahlia Sori is expected to graduate this May with a Bachelor's of Science in Renewable Energy. Sori moved to Lubbock with the original intent to get as far away as she could from Southeast Texas after having discovered she identified as a woman. She was surprised to see a vibrant, openly queer community that resided in the region. Sori talked about her involvement in the Texas Tech Gender and Sexuality Association. She noted that was once a visible community has now dwindled in the face of discrimination.
Most days I don't try to look very queer, and I know that I see fewer queer strangers that I can tell, oh, they look like they are queer, they're dressing in that style. I see less of those, and I feel like that makes sense because they'd be more scared to present that way, even on campus.
Sori sought legal advice from an attorney provided by the Texas Tech Student Legal Services over her rights as both a student and trans person in Texas. One of her questions was about changing her name.
In Texas, you need to have a valid reason for a judge to sign off on a name change. Now, that could be marriage, that could be a cultural thing, but being transgender is no longer a valid reason. The attorney that I spoke to didn't even feel like applying was worth trying.
In a January interview conducted by NBC5, Creighton stated that the flowchart and guidance memorandum he provided does not politically lean one way or the other, but it is just what he called, quote, common sense. He went on to say that Texas Tech seeks to provide a curriculum that leads to a, quote, degree of value. When asked if Crane considered gender studies to be considered a degree of value, he stated that he had not seen the data to support that conclusion. When asked what she would say to Creighton if he sat down to talk to her, Sori said she would start with one word.
Resign. Whomever in the Texas government exerting their power over this university and instating the leadership that they want to see. The chancellor's, or Creighton, is definitely a symptom of that. And I feel like that should not be how it is. That's not how universities should operate.
I'm Michelle Weda in Lubbock.
This is the West Texas Dispatch. 22 years ago, Carol and Glenn Dromgoole decided to give downtown Abilene retail a chance. Sure, other businesses have come and gone, but since that downtown restoration began in earnest in the late 1980s, perhaps no retail store can say they have ridden the storm quite as well as the Texas Star Trading Company. Now Carol and Glenn say they're ready to retire again, and they're wanting to hand the keys to another entrepreneur and, quote, do the other things with their lives. Carol and Glenn join us in the studio. Thanks for joining us both today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Carol, first up, how hard was this decision to move on?
Well, it's been kind of hard. I have a lot of mixed feelings about it, but it's time. And I think there's a lot of opportunity for somebody with more energy to take Texas Star to another level, perhaps.
When you guys were making this decision, did it seem to just come on you pretty suddenly, or did you gradually make this decision?
Oh, I would say it came on kind of suddenly after at the end of last year.
Yeah,
last year was a hard year because of the construction downtown And we had a really, it was a really rough year. And then we had a very good and very prosperous, very successful Christmas season. But we had to work every day. Carol and I worked every day, December 1st through 24th. And we were tired by the time that was over. And so we started thinking about maybe it's time, we might not want to go through that again.
So you've gotten through this road construction, which was a booger bear to deal with. There's no, yes. We did it at the Paramount down the street.
Yes.
I know. But you've gotten through this. It's supposed to be done in the next 4 to 6 weeks or so, with
right.
it mostly.
Right.
So you guys would be handing these keys off to somebody who's got a brand new downtown to work in.
Well, we felt like it was a good time. We didn't want to try to retire last year because I think it would have been hard to sell our store when it was covered in black fencing. And so we thought maybe this would be a good opportunity.
Yeah. Glenn, let me ask you this. 22 years, you've seen some changes, I would think, in downtown. The number of people walking downtown, the business climate. What's your perspective been?
Yeah, downtown's really changed a lot over that period. But it's really now reached the point where I think it's really ready to take off because of with the construction finished on Cypress Street, pretty much, then there's going to be lights and there's going to be, just wide sidewalks and just it's going to really be very, I think, very attractive to people. When we decided to locate downtown with this store, there wasn't a better place to be than downtown for the kind of store we had.
Yeah.
We started off as strictly Texas books with very few little gift items, not much. And then as we decided to expand that into a more general Texas store at the location where we are now, and we started off down by the Paramount Theater and for 3 years, and then we moved to where we are now at 2nd and Cypress, that's just right in the middle of all the activity. And we've seen a whole lot of development downtown, and not as much retail development, but a lot of other things that are going on.
That's true. There's just not that much retail going on, Cedar, Cypress, that sort of area. Although that's picked up with 7-1-1 Books right around the
yes.
corner. What lessons have you learned, Carol, in retail these last 22 years? What have you taken with you?
Well, customer service is by far the most important thing. And when we started, like Glenn said, we were really just a bookstore. And, we didn't want to be a tacky souvenir shop, but people kept coming in, where are your postcards? Where are your magnets and your shot glasses? So we finally gave in.
The market had spoken.
Yes, yes. We try not to have too many tacky things, but we do have a few.
You guys have also mixed it up. I mean, there's a lot of events. I know I've come to a couple of times where there's some book authors signing books. I mean, mm-hmm. there's things going on in your store.
Well, we've had that's been one of the things we've tried to emphasize all the time is having local authors in and also Texas authors that have come in. Probably the most the craziest one we had was Kinky Friedman.
The first one that came to mind. Exactly.
And we had him the first year we were open.
Yeah.
And it really kind of put us on the map because he was such a draw and he had never been to Abilene. And we had a line for 2 hours, people wanting to get him to sign their books and so on. So that was quite an experience. But we've had, a lot of other good offers. Elmer Kelton, of course, was a favorite of everybody. And he came every year for, the first 7 or 8 years we were open, and then even before he died. But he was great. John Erickson, Hank the Cow Dog, yeah. Man, he draws huge crowds. So we've had him several times.
You guys have kind of a unique story as far as, you had other jobs, and you had basically retired and went, enough of this retirement stuff. Let's do something else. Is that a good way to describe it?
Yeah, well, Glenn keeps trying to retire, and I wouldn't let him. And so, anyway, I'm finally going to let him, I think.
So what are your hopes for the Texas Star Trading Company? Where do you want it to be in 5, 10 years?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. We haven't really thought about that. We'd just like for somebody to come in and take it over and maybe, step it up a little bit. I think there's some opportunities there for people to stay open a little later, for our store to stay open later, be open on Sundays maybe. And we just don't have the energy to do that. It's really – and we also have a website that has a lot of potential for growth.
Yeah.
And we've had the website for a good many years, but it's just been kind of whatever we could get from it. We haven't really pushed it all that much. But that's, I think that's an opportunity for somebody to really take that a little more.
So for now, business as usual, Carol?
Yes, absolutely. We are still, we had two book signings Saturday, and we're still open and selling and ordering things. And so we plan to continue that for the time being until we find a buyer.
All right. Then what? You're going to travel? I mean, suddenly the store isn't just holding you down, right? You can get out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we have grandchildren in Colorado that we'd like to see a little bit more often. And, yeah, there's maybe some places we want to go. And
there you go.
Carol's excited that we now have a direct flight from Abilene to Denver.
Yes, yes.
And Tucson and Phoenix and Houston. They were like, they knew you guys were retiring, so
yeah,
they added all these flights.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so nice of them. Carol and Glenn Dromgoole, thank you for joining us on the West Texas Dispatch.
Thank you.
You can find information on the purchase of the Texas Star Trading Company at AbilenAcquisitions.com. It's time for West Texas Roots. In February, we talked to many interested people at the Texas Farm, Ranch, and Wildlife Expo. We gathered family stories, holiday stories, personal stories, all painting a beautiful picture about the history of West Texas. Lola Bailey's story is one that takes us back to a time most may not be familiar with, and only a few have experienced, when schools truly took place in one room, the one-room schoolhouse. Teaching only about a dozen students, ranging from five different grade levels, Lola tells us about how she was the very last teacher at the very last one-room schoolhouse in Texas.
I closed the last one-room schoolhouse in Texas. The reason that we had to close because of Senate Bill 1. It's located on the other side of Van Horn. Van Horn on the other side of it has a different time zone, but it's before you get to Cerro Blanco. I came to work in Van Horn, and then they needed the superintendent over there. So I applied and it was accepted. I was the superintendent and the teacher. I ran the whole school. We had about five grade levels. We had one in the sixth, a couple in three in kindergarten, and I hired an aide because they were special need kids. So we had everything we needed. The money was there until it wasn't. We had over a dozen students. They were students that came in from the ranches. Their daddies were either managers or owned it or something. And so they provided their own transportation. I paid them money to drive in. It was a white stucco building. We did a lot of field trips because I had a nice pickup, and we just put all the kids in and we took off to wherever we wanted to go. We went up in the mountains and let them walk around and run around, you know, being kids. It was very interesting and it was really good, and the kids did well in school. The interesting part was that all of them were in the same room. So if I had something, a lecture that was really good in one subject, I'd see all the heads go. I'd say, you have to do your work, you know, don't look towards us, try not to listen. And they got to where they could do that. They brought their lunches, had a microwave, heated it that way. I was trying to think, it was when my mother died, is when, I think it was 92, was at school when I got the message. So yes, it was very traumatic and for them too. But the people were very kind to us, they helped us. The neighbors, everybody did. It closed in 95, I think. It was a neat thing, but the neatest thing was they gave me some good publicity. I made the Dallas Morning News front and second page of it. I made the El Paso Times, pictures of the kids and the whole story of that. And then CNN came in. When we had that ran on TV, it was Wolf
Blitzer.
That's who did it.
That's right.
That's who did it. He sent two reporters out and they stayed 2 days. And then he took all the information, and I have it too. He was a very nice man, but the kids are successful. I still hear from them Christmas time and other times. They'll write me letters. It was a neat experience. I came back to finish out in Abilene.
We recorded Lola Daly's story about the last one-room schoolhouse in Texas at the Taylor County Expo Center. If you've got a story to tell or know someone who should be talking to us, let us know. We'd love to meet you and them. Send us an email at info@kacu.org with the subject line, Roots, or give us a call, 325-674-2441. This is the West Texas Dispatch. Coming up this weekend, local residents have a chance to get creative with pieces of Abilene's history during an event aimed at helping to preserve that very history. KACU's Kason Higgins has more on the Abilene Preservation League's Brick Painting Party.
As nonprofits across all sectors try fresh approaches to fundraising, the Abilene Preservation League is combining creativity with their mission. On Saturday, APL will lay out brushes and paints, along with red bricks from Abilene's past, for guests to decorate at the Elks Art Center Ballroom.
The ball ranges. We don't have all of them right here. But like this one behind is where we need to print it.
Coriander Taylor, the league's creative program coordinator and historian, says the bricks being used carry a deep local significance.
The cool thing with the brick company is it's been around, or it was around, since the early 1900s, 1909, about that time. And over time, it changed names and changed owners a lot. But the main breadth of it is that it helped build Abilene.
Taylor says the company shipped bricks by rail across the country before closing in the late 1980s. Local researcher Paul Smith will give a short presentation on that history before painting begins. Community engagement and events manager Caitlin Ferguson says the Elks Arts Center Ballroom was the right fit for the event.
The ballroom is the oldest in the big country. The building has been established since 1913. So just kind of like how the bricks were used for some of the buildings, the older buildings here in downtown and then throughout Abilene, it just kind of pairs well.
The Abilene Preservation League was established in 1977. Executive Director Abigail Payne says the idea for the event came together almost by chance. She was speaking with new board member Kelly Olbricht, who mentioned her artist friend Katie Grace and the concept of painting Abilene bricks, and the two immediately saw it as a fundraising opportunity. Ferguson says no artistic experience is necessary to attend.
Anybody that doesn't have any artistic ability or creativity, that's okay, because these bricks and painting these bricks are made to be your own, to take with you, and then just kind of learn the history behind it.
Attendees will receive a brick, painting supplies, and a step-by-step tutorial led by artist Katie Grace Pacheco. Each $20 ticket also includes light refreshments and an entry into a live raffle. Those who want an extra brick as a keepsake can special order additional ones directly through Katie Grace. As of today, only 4 tickets remain. The Brick Painting Party is this Saturday, March 28th, from 10 to noon at the Elks Arts Center Ballroom in downtown Abilene. For more information or to become a league member, visit abilenepreservation.org. I'm Kason Higgins in Abilene.
Our next installment of KACU's 40th birthday flashback series checks in with a student host who returned after graduation to work full-time for KACU. Zane Goggins helped this station serve Abilene in the big country through his undergraduate degree years and came on full-time as the operations director while he completed his graduate studies. He sent us this.
Happy birthday, KACU. This is Zane Goggins. I was an announcer and a reporter there from 2009 to 2013, and then I got to come back in 2015 to serve as the Director of Operations and Programming until 2022. So KACU has been a big part of my life, so over a decade. I was there for the 25th birthday and the 30th and the 35th. So I'm honored to be able to say happy birthday on KACU's 40th birthday. KACU means the absolute world to me. As a student, I learned how to do journalism, but not just that, but to do it in real time, while also being given the grace to make mistakes, like saying Abilene instead of Abilene. And if you're the caller who called me during my shift to tell me how wrong I was, you know who you are, but I'm also grateful for it. As an adult, I learned how to work in the professional world, but also I got to pursue the things that I wanted to do, like making podcasts with Floyd Miller and with Corey Patterson. But I'm really grateful to KACU for allowing me to pursue a master's degree while also working there full time. And it's because of that I'm now doing what I get to do, what I've always wanted to do, which is to be in ministry. I'm the lead pastor of Sweetwater Christian Church down here in Sugar Land, Texas. So if you're ever in the Houston area, come by and come see me. But I owe where I am today to KACU. And this little station is more than just the things that it puts out on the air. This station is the people. The value of it is more than just what you hear on the radio. It's the people that make this place special. And it's the listeners that make this thing special. And it's really worth your support. I'm a product of all the support that has been going into this little radio station for the last, 15 years. And I just want to say thank you for that. And this little station deserves a little birthday gift from you. And so I just wanted to say happy birthday. Thanks for having me on. And I just got to try this one more time. You're listening to KACU 89.5 Abilene. Happy birthday.
Zane Goggins, former student host and operations director for KACU. We've got some more flashbacks coming up, and we appreciate all the birthday wishes and updates that our former students and staff have been sharing. We're adding a version to our social media pages on Facebook and Instagram at KACU895. And if there's someone you remember and would like to hear from, let us know. Send us a message at info@kacu.org. Thanks for tuning in to the West Texas Dispatch. We're here each Wednesday at noon. Plan to join us and tell a friend. And never miss an episode. When you subscribe to the podcast, it's available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can also find it on the KACU website and the mobile app. We had help this week from our executive producer, Heather Claiborne, and producers Shayla Conley and Kalem Leger. We also had help from our digital editor, Calvin Claiborne. Special thanks to J.C. Gamble, who wrote our theme. I'm George Levesque.